from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I take a look at a new book about the history of the L.S. Ayers store.
I'll find out about a historic party at the Indiana Landmark Center.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Stutz Spring Open House. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. To generations of Indianapolis residents, a shopping trip meant one destination above all others, a visit to L.S. Ayers at Washington and Meridian Streets. 8 full floors of merchandise, plus a separate men's store, bargain store, and the requisite repast at the elegant tea room could take an entire day. Sharon Gamble invited Ken Turchi to our studios to talk about his new book, L.S. Ayers, The Store at the Crossroads of America. He began by reading an excerpt.
Philomena Gould, the Indianapolis News longtime women's correspondent, enthused about the inventory in Ayers' new Gourmets UN when the store acquired Charles Meyer & Company's food pantry in 1954. She described the marron glacé, the petit four, oat cakes, Drosti's chocolates, Danish butter cakes, and beluga caviar. As a matter of fact, she said, offering a novel solution for ending the Cold War, caviar, close harmony, and fancy dancing are 3 good reasons why I wish the Russians would settle down and act nice.
I love it. So I have to say, I've taken your book. I take the dust jackets off books when I read them. I know the dust jackets are there to protect the books, but I take the dust jacket off to protect the dust jacket. And the book itself is an unmistakable Ayers Robin's Egg blue
right.
color with the logo.
Right.
And when I've had this at a casual restaurant, I've been reading it. People of a certain age recognize it and come over and start telling their Ayers stories. And there's almost a kind of fetishism. I grew up in the Los Angeles area, and that was the world of malls in the 1960s when
right.
I grew up. There were fabulous malls with great department stores like the Broadway and Bullocks and so forth. But I moved here as a girl and to live with a different part of my family, and I was introduced to this idea of the downtown Ayers store. We lived in Irvington. We would go downtown and spend an entire Saturday Christmas shopping or back-to-school shopping, and we'd take a loop through blocks and maybe through Wasson's. Ayers was the destination, and there was something on every floor
right.
that we needed, or at least needed to look at,
right.
and it's a different way of life that you've captured so beautifully in this book. What caused you to, I know you worked at Ayers for a while in your undergraduate years, right?
Right.
But what made you want to delve into the mystique?
I've always been really interested in retailing. I think if I'd been a little older, maybe, and the department store business had still been really viable, but it was starting not to be in the late 70s, I probably would have gone to work for Ayers. I was intrigued by their success as a legendary department store, but also by the ability of their management to look ahead and realize that they needed to be in more than just the department store business, and the reasoning behind their diversification and the success of the store is really, it's quite an interesting business story as well as a nostalgic story.
And it's just kind of makes you so sad by the end of the book, because you see you've painted this beautiful arc of brilliant leadership, largely family leadership,
yes.
for such a long time, and you think, oh, why couldn't this have persisted? But, you know, the way we shop has changed, of course, and even before the digital age, the way we shop had changed.
Right. The department store business began to get very promotional in the late 70s, and another big factor in the change was that women entered the workforce in greater numbers and didn't have time to go downtown and spend the whole day browsing around in the store.
Sure.
Shopping became more of a thing to do on the to-do list than an experience itself.
Right. You didn't get dressed up and put on your nicest hat and go have lunch in the tea room and look at the models or listen to Carolyn Churchman's radio show or whatever. But Ayers was set itself apart at the very beginning. Take us back to the very beginning and what they did differently, how they saw it differently.
In the 1870s, when Lyman Ayers came to Indianapolis, he took over the management of a store called the Trade Palace. And he positioned it, in his words, as a first-class, one-price establishment. Ayers was one of the first stores in the city, if not the first, to sell quality merchandise, beautifully merchandised with good lighting and good presentation, and quality merchandise at whatever price you were able to pay. And then after the First World War, Ayers converted their customers very successfully from custom-made clothes made by a dressmaker on the sixth floor to ready-made clothes by forming alliances with the burgeoning group of 7th Avenue designers. So Ayers always had a lot of currency, a lot of cachet, and a lot of respect from the designers in New York, and that really became the platform of their building the whole store around quality merchandise, leading with women's fashion, and the pinnacle of which was their relationship with the designers and that Ayers look, which was a slogan they introduced in 1936 and continued to use for 50 years after that.
And it's hard to overstate the amazing feat of establishing Ayers as a fashion leader in a world where Indianapolis was, well, flyover zone. I mean, long before commercial aircraft, Indianapolis was nowhere. People didn't really think about Indianapolis. They might have thought about Chicago, but even Chicago took a distant backseat to New York. And there was this Philip Meyer made a very important role for himself in this transition.
Yes, he was one of the custom dressmakers, about the last one that they had. And he certainly was very important in the custom dressmaking. But he and Ted Griffith, who was, you mentioned the Ayers family, he was part of the Ayers family. He and Ted Griffith and Fred Ayers really moved the more affluent Ayers customer into the concept of buying high-quality ready-made clothes. But the brilliant thing that they did with that was that they made that promise, that brand promise, available to anybody. And the store had a very large, it was called the Downstairs Store until the 60s, and then was renamed. The Downstairs Store was where a lot of people shopped, and I was told as recently as last week by a former executive that the Downstairs Store carried the rest of the store, all 8 floors above the basement, throughout the Depression. So it was a popular place to shop, and it was a way for young people to get introduced to Ayers at prices that they could afford.
And there's something kind of astonishing and altruistic about a lot of the policies of Ayers as far as making sure people were treated with dignity, even if they could only afford to shop in the Downstairs store.
Right. The store spent a lot of money on and a lot of time on training people to sell, on helping them see that they were there for the customer's benefit, to help them get what was right for them without having to spend a penny more than they needed to. And it was also a good place to work. All of the retired folks that I spoke with who worked there said that the Ayers family was very good to its employees. And, you know, this was at a time when business was more than just seeing how much wealth you could amass in a short time. The store had slow and steady growth, and even after it went public in 1954, returned good dividends to its shareholders.
There was also a nimbleness to their policies, in particular a shared aesthetic and ethic about reinvention, both in the merger and acquisition phase, but also in the commitment to long-term growth. I mean, the idea of giving people invitations at a 50th anniversary celebration of your store and saying, come back with your youngest great-grandchild 50 years from now.
Wasn't that something? And, you know, because they did exactly that. They had a movie on the circle with the live performance, and when people went to that movie, they gave them a card that says bring this back in 1972. And it was fun to read in the archives the process of the Ayers promotional people trying to track down people that had those cards 50 years later. And it turned out there was a small enough number that they sent each of them $100 rather than having another celebration.
Sure.
Because they were flung far and wide too, sure. 50 years later.
And in the spirit of the who are we now, the reinvention, there's that big transition to ready-to-wear. But there's also a transition as they realized that, say, neighborhood grocery stores were now more populous, neighborhood places where you could buy such things as notions or personal care items. But I was showing this book to a colleague the other day, and she said, oh, yes, when my sisters and I were young and we needed certain personal care items, my mother bought them at Ayers and had them delivered by truck to our home so we didn't have to carry them through
right.
the store. I love that.
That's right. Delivery was great. I was a great feature of the store, and it's completely gone now, but I was visiting with some people the other night, and I'd heard this story, but I thought maybe it was apocryphal, and now I know it's true because a woman told me that she was home one day sewing, and she needed a spool of red thread. And, at that time, people had one car per family, if any, so she didn't have a car.
And there was no CVS on the corner.
No CVS on the corner. So she called Ayers, and they delivered a spool of thread to her house.
Oh, my Lord.
It actually happened.
That is customer service.
Sure
I love
is.
That. And then some clever sales techniques when they realized it's costing us too much to deliver stuff. So
right.
So training salespeople to say things like, you will take this with you.
Yes, you can take this home right away. They had a delightful painting of a little cat carrying a kitten. And
aww.
Above it were the words, take the little packages with you.
Oh, I love it. I went with colleagues on the last day the tea room was open. And, of course, there was the world's longest line to
yes.
get in. And
yes.
everybody was in tears
yes.
because there were waitresses who'd worked there
right.
decades.
Right.
Decades.
It was, if you went to work at Ayers, you pretty much stayed there for a long time. And they were very good to their people. And the tea room was a brilliant invention because it... initially, it was open because in the 20s, because or even in 1905, it was opened because unescorted women did not eat out alone, so
sure.
they had to have a respectable place to eat. But in the later years, the tea room was never operated with the premise that it had to make money. It was a way to bring people into the store, and of course, it kept them in the store longer. So it was a good business decision, even though that particular service of the store was not a moneymaker.
And that takes some real guts to
yes.
make that kind of a commitment, to know that you not everything has to be profitable.
Right.
That on balance, it's all going to work out. What do you think Ayers' legacy is, in particular to Indianapolis?
There's a very tangible legacy of Ayers in the form of the Ayers Foundation, which is still very much around and which underwrote quite a bit of the cost of my book. But then there's also a more intangible legacy of there was a time when people treated each other well, and when going somewhere was an experience, and Ayers always made a promise to their customers of treating them well and giving them good products and services at whatever price. And that's a legacy that's very hard to duplicate in today's world of digital sales, and where everything really is focused on price more than on value.
Sharon Gamble with Ken Turchi. He'll be featured signing his book, Ellis Ayers, The Store at the Crossroads of America, at the luncheon at the Propylaeum on May 1st. You're invited to celebrate that Ayers look by donning your finest hat and gloves. More information about the luncheon is at thepropylaeum.org. Now, that's spelled The, thepropylaeum.org, thepropylaeum.org. You can learn more about the book at ihspressblogspot.com. Again, ihspress.blogspot.com, and find the book at most bookstores. By the way, the Indiana State Museum has several artifacts from the downtown Ellis Ayers store.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Indiana Landmarks is throwing a historic party to support its 10 most endangered properties, which are announced annually. Full disclosure, that's where my day job is. So I invited Travis DiNicola to talk with Indiana Landmarks President Marsh Davis about the April 27th rescue party and the program that it benefits.
Marsh, welcome to Art of the Matter.
Thanks, Travis. Glad to be here.
Great to see you. We will be talking about the second annual rescue party in just a moment. It does not involve a St. Bernard going out into the wilds at all, but definitely has some interesting beverages. Let's start, though, with talking about what Indiana Landmarks is. You're an advocacy organization. You're a physical center. There's so many things, but help me understand that a little bit better.
Well, it's a great question because a lot of people don't really understand what Indiana Landmarks is, even though we've been around since 1960. We are a statewide nonprofit organization devoted to saving historic places, meaningful places across Indiana, and we do it in a whole variety of ways. We are by the way, we are the largest such organization in the country.
Indiana really?
Has the largest statewide nonprofit organization, formerly known as Historic Landmarks Foundation
yes.
of Indiana, often confused with all manner of other historic organizations. So we lightened the load a bit and changed our name to Indiana Landmarks, sort of a natural flow. And hopefully creating a little bit of a distinction, not that we don't enjoy our brothers in the other organizations, but...
But the core focus really is that rescue component, right? I mean, if landmarks that are possibly endangered, that's where you guys go in and save them, essentially.
Well, both there's kind of the reactive side where we come and try to save something that's endangered, but I think just as importantly is our mission to educate people as to the value of what we have in our own communities and hopefully get things before they become endangered, get people to invest in them, to see that these neighborhoods and buildings and great places have economic value in our community and really support the quality of life. We've seen that all over the state, and that's really the essence of our mission.
Education, sustainability, preserving, yes. rescuing, combination of all of those. So, because I know, you know, some people sort of may get confused and think, oh, you're a history organization. Obviously, history is a big part of it, but it's focused on the physical buildings.
That's correct. We are not an archival institution. Mm-hmm. We value history as layers of meanings, but it's really about places.
Mm-hmm.
In a word, I think place is the best.
Even more than buildings, of course, because places are certainly a part of it. Give me an example of some of your recent successes, if you will.
Well, the most recent big thing was, of course, the completion of the Indiana Landmarks Center, the former Central Avenue United Methodist Church, which was just almost 2 years ago we had the grand opening.
And what an amazing building it is.
Yeah, that's one that really helped change the scope of our organization. That you mentioned initially that we're about advocacy and education, but we also have historic places.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving away from the museum approach to things and having historic places that are highly interactive. And the Indiana Landmarks Center has just performed beautifully in that regard. Everything from weddings to concerts to lectures. Our own educational symposia and so forth.
I've been fortunate to be doing a number of events there, and you actually have. I mean, people can go in and look at that space and check that out because it really is such an amazing space, and the renovation that you've achieved with that is terrific.
Thank you.
Other successes, as you said, you're a statewide organization, and you know I know that certainly each year you call attention through the endangered list as far as different buildings and spaces. What's another recent one?
Well, I would say Busch Stadium is one that's a very prominent local one.
This was one of my favorites.
Yeah, this was on our list of 10 most endangered places twice over the years. And recently, working with our former board chairman John Watson, we got before a committee that the mayor had appointed to look into the revitalization of that area, and they accepted John's proposal as the favored one to revitalize the stadium instead of scraping it, which was probably that was the conventional thinking at the time. This thing has outlived itself. It's time to clean the slate.
And literally become a junkyard for a while.
Yes,
there.
Cash for clunkers.
Yeah, and now apartments.
That's right.
What a great idea.
Well, it preserves the essence of the place. You know, it's not a purist approach to preservation, but that's what we have to do in many cases is to
Because it wasn't going to necessarily be a functional ballpark again,
but by
preserving it with the apartments and turning it into this residential facility, I mean, you still keep a lot of the historic building and sense of it.
Yes, and it's really
new function, though.
Really coming along. That's one recently that we've worked on. Another one that's a similar kind of blend of old and new is the old St. Vincent Hospital that was nearly demolished, and we were able to work with a committee through Ivy Tech, and the solution was to save the major historic components of the building, blending it with old and new construction. Again, not a purist approach, but the kind of thing that we often see. There are other cases, though, where a much more intensive historic approach has been taken, and I think a project that we are happily associated with over time is the West Baden Springs Hotel.
Of course.
Which Indiana Landmarks purchased in the 1990s when it was literally a ruin. It was falling down, and our job was to buy it, a very gutsy thing to do, buy it and save it from a total collapse. Now, it's sort of a Cinderella story as the Cook family became interested, and now it's one of the most spectacular preservation projects in the world. It is just, you know, first rate. And
I'm going down there in just a few weeks. I'm looking forward to it very much. And it really is. It's great to hear you talk about these, because then a lot of people are aware of these projects. They drive by them, they see them, they hear about them, but maybe they're not exactly aware of what Indiana Landmarks' role is in it. Obviously, you work with lots of partners, municipal partners, private, public, not-for-profits, donors. That's a big part of what you do as well.
Yes, and a lot of what we do is simply connecting people to projects. That's same with what happened with Busch Stadium and the wonderful event that's happening there, and with French Lick, West Baden. Sometimes we start with a small grant that we provide. We also, what distinguishes us from our peer organizations around the country is that we have 9 offices around the state. We're not just in the state capital, but we serve the state with people on the ground who are preservation professionals. So we try to keep a really healthy outreach evenly spread throughout the state. So it's that first point of contact, connecting people to places, and trying to bring the resources to bear, whether it's our own money or attracting others to invest in these great projects.
Well, let's talk about the upcoming event, which is also great and a lot of fun, and will be making its own history that night, and that, of course, is the second annual rescue party that is taking place at the Indiana Landmarks Center, and it will be on April 27th, starting at 6 o'clock, and I know last year I heard lots of people talking about what a great party this was, a lot of fun elements, everything from awards and a cocktail competition and Sun King beer and an art show. Where do we even begin? Because it's just a fun event.
Well, we'll start with the mission. It is a fundraising event to support our program. So that's it. It does go to the core of our mission. But this is not your typical chicken dinner fundraising event. This is
very
this
good.
Party. I mean, if this year is anything like last year, and it surely promises to be, it's going to be fun. We have music, all variety of food. We have 5 caterers providing food throughout the evening, dessert.
I know the Impalas are going to be playing. They're always a good party band. What I want to talk about, maybe first let's start with the cocktail competition. This is something you guys did last year, and it's actually, I know, arranged through the U.S. Bartenders Guild, and there's been preliminary rounds, and how does this play out? Because, I mean, it's a lot of sort of old-fashioned style, historical type of cocktails that bartenders are really getting into these days at different taverns around town, and this is a chance for them to go glass to glass.
Yeah, fortunately, it's a trend. I mean, the cocktails that are available now are amazing in variety, and there's a lot of pre-prohibition style. This came about as sort of a Iron Chef approach to making cocktails and given set ingredients. And last year was great fun, and I'm looking forward to this year's concoction, which will be based on rye whiskey.
Very good, very good. Okay, so the bartenders will go in there, and they'll know that they're working with rye, and then find out all the mystery ingredients. Is that the idea?
That's it. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Very cool. And then we were talking a bit actually before we went on about Sun King Brewery and how they're just such great supporters of many not-for-profits in town. They're actually Help me understand this, because I know there was an event that actually occurred before our interview right now goes on air, and that involves Sun King and one of my favorite groups, Time for Three, great classical garage band music, and the Catacombs, is that right?
Yes.
Am I pulling this all together
here?
Okay. And Sun King, what, made a beer with Time for Three for you guys?
Well, Time for Three has composed a piece of music in honor of Rescue Party. And the beer that Sun King is brewing is going to be based on that music. So
that's awesome.
And all has been unveiled in the Catacombs. So yes,
that's really cool. That's very fun. And so so that new Sun King beer will be available, of course, at your party.
Yes, and what wonderful people they are, and the product is excellent. So. Very good. Come on and try it.
Now, that night, you also do reveal your announcement of your annual list of the 10 most endangered places, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so how does that process, how do you go about determining what the 10 most endangered places are? Because I've seen the list come out every year. I mean, it's new that you actually have a party to announce it, but right. But it was always something that was released to the press and in the paper, and you know, some people really took note each year. But how do you decide the 10?
We do our best to have geographic diversity of resource types. You know, we could have endangered places in one corner of the state and have but we try to spread it out. So that's that's, again, with our people on the ground across Indiana, we have a pretty good sense of what the endangered places are. But these are places that have really great significance, and what it does, it tells us these are some of our priority projects for the upcoming year. We try to keep the list as fluid as possible, but you can't always. These projects sometimes take years to complete, but we do try to get the list freshened as much as possible each year. But there are inevitably some carryovers,
sure,
from year to year.
Well, and as you mentioned, I think you said Busch Stadium was on there twice.
Yeah,
right. So, and do you find, I mean, that this list is a successful way to bring attention, that focus, narrow that focus on those areas, maybe highlight some buildings or places that people didn't even realize were out there or didn't realize were endangered?
Well, again, looking back over time, the list has been very successful. I think our success rate is somewhere in the 80%,
wow, okay.
80% plus as far as saves versus losses. But they do have to be legitimately endangered. I think there are a couple that really stand out. And, you know, West Baden was one.
Sure.
The Beck's Mill down in southern Indiana, old grist mill, was on the list. And its salvation came about because of the notoriety that was created by the 10 most endangered list. One of our current listings, of the 2012 listings, was the Taggart Memorial out in Riverside Park.
Oh, okay.
And just to show an example of how, by putting this front and center, we created a task force, and the task force is now very effectively moving forward with a plan to preserve this structure. And say, we already have put a new roof on it, which has arrested the decay. We put organizational emphasis, financial emphasis on these 10 most endangered places.
Very good. So, well, that'll be an important night of the evening when that announcement is made. Let me ask you real quickly. I know there's other elements that are part of the Rescue Party, including the work of Brock Sagan, excuse me. Also, live auction, things like that going on. Any highlights you want to mention that you think will draw people in? And
well, they're all good. I mean, Brock Sagan's art, if you've not seen it, is really, I think, remarkable. Based on historic photographs, but with a modern painterly technique that you can see his work.
And I know the show is called Color in Historic Indiana. So, okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with his work, so I'm looking forward to seeing that.
And of course, we've talked about the cocktail contest, which is great fun. The auction, Dennis Jackson will be back for a second year, and this was, it was just, you know, a lot of fun, a lot of laughter.
Great unique and, items and
yes, and all for a good cause, to be sure. And the Impalas are much fun. We'll even have some karaoke, and you can bid, you can pay to participate, or you can pay to get the karaoke to stop.
So, very good. As long as you have both options.
Yeah.
Well, Marsh, it sounds like it's just going to be a great party. Looking forward to that. I know it's a great celebration of the work that Indiana Landmarks does, and it's a great way, especially maybe for people who aren't as familiar with your organization, to find out more that night, and especially check out the 10 most endangered list.
Yeah, and it is fun. It puts a different slant on preservation. So I think some people think we're a rather stuffy lot. This will prove otherwise.
Shake them up a bit, along with a few cocktails. Very good, Marsh. Thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter.
Thank you, Travis. Great to be here.
Travis DiNicola with Indiana Landmarks President Marsh Davis. Find out more about Rescue Party at indianalandmarks.org. That party's coming up on Saturday, April 27th from 6 to 11 at the new Indiana Landmarks Center at 1201 Central Avenue. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Question is, what do we do? Hey, what do you have?
Nicely done. Hey, you know what? This weekend is Record Store Day. This is a really fun day. And you know, a lot of record stores, I mean, Luna, of course, and other record stores are selling vinyl and all that stuff, which is excellent. But if you want to pick up some records and maybe you don't still have a record player, let me just let you know that you can buy turntables at the Turntable Shop. That's at 2121 East 10th Street. You can also visit them at the Turntable Shop, shop spelled S-H-O-P-P-E .com to get more information. And they're having lots of fun specials today, and well, not today, but on Saturday, Record Store Day. If you're listening to us on Saturday, it's Record Store Day. But what a great thing to do.
I love that.
Yeah,
so you can get the vinyl and something to play it on.
There you go.
Fantastic. Love it. Hey, there is a production at Spotlight Players in Beech Grove of William Mastrosimone's Extremities, and not only is it a theater production, it is partly a fundraiser to combat sexual assault. This is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and the Spotlight folks are doing some great outreach efforts. That production goes through May 5th. Not too many more opportunities to go see that, but check that out. William Mastrosimone's Extremities at Spotlight in Beech Grove.
Hey, coming up on May 3rd for a First Friday exhibition. This is pretty cool. The show is called What's for Dinner, and it's a new series of 3D pop art paintings that are all sort of these interesting caricatures made out of food. I mean, at least they look like sort of, well, dancing bananas and toast and whatever. It's all by this artist. He's from Portland, artist named Tripper Dungan. So again, this show is on May 3rd. It's opening at the Monster Gallery. That's the gallery that artists and photographer artist Mab Graves and photographer Larry Endicott run. The gallery is located on English Avenue, right at the intersection of State and English, down Found Square. Really cool gallery space. And so they are bringing in Tripper Dungan for this First Friday opening. Totally unique stuff. Very fun. It's kind of like the 60s styles retro, but also like 3D holograms, but it's all food-based. It's a hoot.
Go hungry.
You'll love it. Like, very cartoony. Yeah, go hungry. There you go.
Love it.
So that's on the 3rd.
Hey, reduce, recycle, reuse, and have a great time at the Earth Day Community Celebration at the JCC. That's this Sunday, the 21st, 11:30 to 3. Lots of family-friendly activities. It's free. There are games and educational things to do as well, but above all, a lot of fun for Earth Day this Sunday at the JCC, 11:30 to 3.
Speaking of the Earth, this weekend is also the IMA plant sale.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going on both Saturday from 11 to 5 and Sunday from noon to 5 at the greenhouse on the grounds of the IMA. And it is just a great day. Lots of all different types of plants, and you can talk to the master gardeners there. And new this year, they even have a Central Indiana Antique Tractor and Engine Association show. So that will be a lot of fun, too, all at the IMA, and a bonsai exhibit. What more do you need? A food truck? Sure. Well, they got those, too. So check it out Saturday and Sunday at the IMA.
I'll be there. Don't buy all my plants before I get there. Do we have time for one more?
You bet.
Speaking of gardens, Orchard in Bloom. Don't forget, that is coming up the first weekend of May, May 3rd through the 5th, at Holiday Park. Draws 7,000 to 9,000 people every year. You can see all sorts of creative ideas for your yard and garden. Orchard in Bloom, May 3rd through the 5th at Holiday Park.
Very good. We'll be back next week with more of
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola.
If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
It's one of the highlights of the season for visual artists and their fans, but it began modestly enough 2 decades ago. It is the Stutz Artists Open House, and Sharon Gamble invited Gail Moore and Tom Potter, co-chairs of this 20th anniversary year, as well as publicist Jen Schmitz-Thomas, to our studios to learn what's in store on April 26th and 27th at the Stutz.
Tom, Gail, were either of you involved with the Stutz 2 decades ago? Or are you a little bit later to the scene?
We've only been at the Stutz about a year and a half now, so we have heard of the Stutz for many years, but had to actually have a studio just about a year and a half.
And you probably had friends, colleagues, associates in the Stutz?
Yes, a couple of photographer friends of mine were in the Stutz, and our family had gone to the open house, so we were familiar with it from the participation from the public.
And let's talk about your studio before the Stutz and what attracted you to the Stutz.
I was impressed with, first of all, the number of artists there, the synergy that it creates amongst them, because they get together, they share ideas. It's just a really creative location. You can just feel the energy in the place as an artist.
And how important is it to you? I was reading a little bit of your bio on your own website, and you talked about spending quiet, reflective time in an old-fashioned dark room. But I suspect there are times for any artist when having the ability to walk down the hall and talk to somebody else who might have either faced the same technical challenge or the same creative challenge is useful.
Yeah, there's a lot of great ideas that you share. The quiet time is your creative time. You run into a brick wall sometimes, you know, the writer's block thing.
Mm-hmm.
And photographers, any artist has those blocks. And so you get out, you walk down the hall, have a few conversations, and it's like clearing the air.
Hmm. Gail, do you have the same experience?
I think he said pretty much what I feel. It is just fun to see other people's work and to let it kind of ferment in your own mind as, oh, there's an idea, and because I do the photography that I do, you know, it just creates some interest in my mind of maybe here's something I could try.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever come up with a collaboration with fellow artists at the Stutz because of some of those conversations?
There's been some discussion of it. Several of the artists have talked to us about doing a joint project, using some of our interpretation of lines, things like that, shadow, detail, with some of their work. But that's down the road a bit for now. We're too busy to think about those things.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. And Jen, if you want to weigh in here, too, because you've seen this process for a long time. So you guys are relative newbies to the Stutz. And it's like, hey, welcome, new kids. Would you like to co-chair our biggest event of the year? No pressure or anything.
No pressure.
Was there a little arm twisting in that back room there?
Well, actually, I think Gail and I have had some experience with this type of thing in the past. And this year, the call went forth, and there wasn't a lot of excitement because everybody knows how much work is involved. It takes a lot of time away from your art, actually. We have not done much in the last couple of months because of the commitment to this. So we decided, well, we've done this type of thing, so we'll step up. And I think a lot of the detail of this project falls on Gail. She's just excellent at keeping track of things, and I go off on the big picture ideas and get lost out in space, where Gail brings it back home.
30,000-foot view,
right.
3-inch.
Yes. That's exactly why they're a great team, though. They work together in various capacities.
Well, Jen, and you know, Jen is part of the team because she's been around for a number of years. We wouldn't be
part
able
to
do it without.
Part of the continuity, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah.
But I've also seen lots of different approaches, and once the public comes into the venue that first night, it always looks very smooth and seamless. But there's an awful lot of work that goes into it, corralling 80-plus artists.
Corralling, herding cats.
That's
is
not exactly
the other expression
the
you're
phrase
looking
I
for.
Use.
Is that what takes up the lion's share of the time and energy as co-chairs, is just getting artists to let you know what they're planning?
Well, actually, they were excellent at meeting a deadline that we just have, and now I think the detail comes in the graphic design, making sure all the printed pieces are completed and timely so that we can distribute that. And there are permits nowadays to make sure that we have an event that the city sanctions and the state sanctions, and so those are the kind of details that we're working on right now.
Now, but how do you ensure that you're going to have enough work to have your own studio open?
Well,
did you work ahead before saying yes to this?
We work ahead, and we're hoping now that most of the upfront work is done, and we can go back and do some of the creative work for the next month and a half to just supplement what we've been doing over the last year.
That's a really good question, though, Sharon, because having been involved several years, it's about this time that I start saying, now don't forget to make your own artwork, because I can tell you, when an artist isn't able to make his or her art, the artist gets very grumpy. and as it should be. You didn't sign on to be an event planner and host this big event.
Well, it is incredible. I don't, you know, people come and they enjoy the evening, and many of the artists enjoy the evening, but they do a lot of preparation as well, getting their studios ready, expecting the public, having people there to greet people as they come in the door, explain the artwork, because when you have last year in one evening, we had almost 2,000 people walk through our studio.
Wow.
Alone, just our studio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you do not get an opportunity to talk with each one of those people. So we try to encourage the artists, as we were encouraged, to have several other people in the room who are familiar with your work. And that makes a big difference. And I have to say that I can't say enough about the amount of work that goes into this. People come in, they have a good time, and they leave. And Gail and I and our families will plan to head out of town shortly thereafter.
Turning the phones off.
Yeah.
I will say, though, having seen it from a visitor's perspective the last several years, one thing that I always recommend to friends is know which artist's work you like and what you really want to see. And then when you get there, plot a route, because I physically try to be in every artist's studio, and that is a lot of work. Most people probably would give up and go sit down and have a drink or something.
I don't think most people do get to every artist's studio.
It's an effort to really make every studio. Mm-hmm. So kind of plan ahead so that you can stop and really take time to see the art and visit with the artists whose work you really like.
Sure, and you can see the 80 artists at the website, so you can get a little bit of a sneak preview.
Well, one thing that Gail has worked hard on is the program, the Raymond James Stutz Artist Open House program. And the layout there does help as someone comes in. They can look. There are different artists have ads, and they can say, oh, that's a wonderful style. I'd mm-hmm. like to go there, and the name is there. The
and then there's
there.
Figuring out how to get there, though, which
right.
is why it's a good thing there are lots and lots of volunteers stationed throughout, because for anybody who maybe is new to town or hasn't been, this is in the old Stutz Motor Car facility, and it's not always easy to figure out how to get from one level to the other and one corner to the other.
But we have a wonderful crew of volunteers. And part of that volunteer are the Lawrence North Band Boosters, and their students will be there to help raise the elevator gates and to take tickets, but also to direct people and be excellent guides. And on every floor and on every hallway, there'll be a volunteer if you get lost.
In 20 years, no one's been lost yet. We haven't lost
any
guests.
I'm sure people have been lost,
but they haven't been abandoned.
That's right. They haven't been left overnight.
So, Jen, part of celebrating anything that ends in a zero or a five is reminding us of how this started. And I think I've read an anecdote about how Turner and some of the art, and Turner Woodard, who started this great enterprise, is also a visual artist, a painter, right? Mm-hmm. And they just kind of said, oh, we're going to put out some wine and cheese and invite our friends to come. Is that really
that's,
how modest
this
was?
That's the story. That's the story that I've heard. And there were two artists who were at that first event, Turner Woodard and Constance Skopelidis, who have been at every open house since then and will be there this year.
Right.
So the story that Constance has and Turner has shared is that they literally had a plastic kiddie swimming pool. And they put a bunch of ice in it. I don't even think it was as fancy as wine and cheese. They put a bunch of ice in it and some beer. And I said, oh, I wish I had pictures. And she said, are you kidding? We didn't realize it was any big deal.
Sure.
So we don't have pictures, although there are some pictures of the second year and, you know, posters and things that they used because they to promote the third year and on, or second, third year and on through the 20th.
I think it's really important that the community realize the impact that this decision that Turner made to save that building on the verge of destruction, a historic building, and turn it into a fantastic collection of creative spirits, as well as very responsible businesses that are in that building as
mm-hmm.
well, and they are very supportive of the arts. But it's just an incredible visionary and courageous decision.
Well, and we know Turner's a great historic preservationist, but that's a really good point, Tom, because when you think about it, that whole two-block area or four-block area could be completely gone now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my father's company, which was at the same time as the Stutz working downtown Indianapolis. And it was demolished, and it was one of the most famous companies in the United States at the time.
What was it?
That was E.C. Atkins and Company. And they were world famous in the saw business, industrial saws and so on. And the post office now sits where that company was.
Ah, continuity is good, so thank goodness we have some of it. You know, part of why people don't make it to all the artist studios that they care to, Jen, I suspect, is that this event is sort of the thank goodness winter is over, see all your friends again, especially on Friday night. Friday night's kind of the party night, maybe not the night to drag your grade school age kids along. Saturday afternoon is the time to bring the family out.
You know what? This year we'll welcome anybody anytime, but I completely agree. It is a fun social event as well, but of course we like to make sure that we make visits to art studios and buy art. But Saturday afternoon, 2 to 7, is a much quieter time, and a lot of people kind of scout out what they're interested in and then go back the second day.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just don't want the crowd and kind of the party atmosphere.
More time to talk with the artists.
Saturday, mm-hmm. but it is two kind of completely separate types of experiences,
mm-hmm.
so something
mm-hmm.
for everybody.
And on the Saturday, there are some children activities. The Heron School of Art and Design in their community education program has a Saturday school for the children of Indianapolis. And there will be an art exhibit by the Saturday school. And there will be some hands-on children events, as well as some Raymond James sponsored
Ice cream.
And it'll all be
what
up on
that
this.
Coming out?
I don't know.
It's
the
always
time.
While supplies last.
Yes. Yeah.
So that'll be great.
I'd come early.
Yeah, that's a great family event, though, on Saturday afternoon.
But keep your ice cream cupboard paws off Gail and Tom's
right.
photos in yeah. particular, right?
That's right.
One thing I think that because it is the 20th and we really want to encourage people to share in this excitement, this year we're doing something a little bit different also in the way of the opportunity to attend. If a person comes on Friday night, this year their ticket is also good for Saturday.
Excellent.
In the past, there's been a reduced Saturday entry fee mm-hmm. if you've been there Friday. This year we want people to feel welcome. If they have a ticket and they come Friday night, they can come Saturday.
Fantastic. And speaking of tickets, we shouldn't forget that the purpose of having this event is to raise money for the Stutz Residency Program, which means two emerging artists from Indianapolis get free studio space and utilities for a year at the Stutz. And there is an impressive list of artists whose names, many of whom you would recognize, got their start at a Stutz studio from getting that free space.
And some of them have stayed and
Absolutely.
Rented their own studio in years after that first year.
Sharon Gamble with Gail Moore and Tom Potter, co-chairs for the 20th Stutz Artist Open House, and publicist Jen Schmitz-Thomas. The open house is on April 26th and 27th. You can find out about Tom and Gail and their photography before you attend, and learn about the artist residency program that the open house benefits at stutzartist.com. That's Stutz with a Z, stutzartist.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of Medicine's River Roots Festival.
I'll find out about a new film series which shines a light on mental health awareness.
And I'll find out about Footlight Theater's production of Follies. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.